Self-compassion is really radically different than self-esteem because it doesn't involve judgment or evaluation at all. It's basically a way of relating to ourselves kindly, especially relating to ourselves when we're suffering in some way, when we failed or make a mistake or feeling inadequate.
Hello, welcome to Into the Fold, the Hawk Foundation podcast. I'm Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health.
With us today is Dr. Kristen Neff, a professor in the Department of Educational Psychology here at the University of Texas at Austin. She is a self-proclaimed evangelist on the subject of self-compassion and has authored a best-selling book by the same name, and so she's here with us today to share with us her insights on self-compassion, and even for those of us who have a certain level of savviness when it comes to mental health issues, why it is important. So, Dr. Neff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
Okay, so I guess my jumping-off point is a recent TED Talk that you gave. And early in the talk, you make a fundamental distinction between self-compassion and self-esteem. And so for those listening, how are they different and why is the difference important?
Okay, so self-esteem, you can commonly define it as a positive global evaluation of self-worth, a judgment that I'm a good person, right? And as you know, for many, many years, self-esteem was seen to be the ultimate marker of psychological health. Thousands of books written on the topic, money spent in schools to raise kids' self-esteem. And sadly, the whole self-esteem movement has backfired because the problem is not whether or not you have high self-esteem, it's that there are healthy and unhealthy ways to get high self-esteem. And most people actually adopt unhealthy ways. So for instance, in our culture, to have high self-esteem, you have to be special and above average. Everyone has to be special and above average, which is logically impossible, right? So what it sets up is this constant quest to be better than others, to be just that little bit prettier or smarter or more successful. And that can actually lead to some pretty nasty behavior, especially if you look at middle schoolers. That's when bullying starts. Lots of research shows that bullying is actually a quest for high self-esteem. Self-esteem is also contingent on success. So we have it when we're the weight we want, or we get that job, or, you know, we get that date. But what happens when we fail or make a mistake or things aren't going so well for us? Our self-esteem deserts us, right? Precisely when we need it most. So self-compassion is really radically different than self-esteem because it doesn't involve judgment or evaluation at all. It's basically a way of relating to ourselves kindly, especially relating to ourselves when we're suffering in some way, when we failed or make a mistake or feeling inadequate. That's precisely the time that self-compassion comes in and really embraces ourselves with acceptance and care and tenderness. And that's why, in many ways, it's a much more powerful coping mechanism than self-esteem. Certainly more sustainable. I got to be as being perfect to have self-esteem. To have self-compassion. So, yeah.
Okay, then. So I guess part two of that, self-compassion. What are its underlying or core principles?
Core principles, right. So, compassion for self or others really has to do with concern with the alleviation of suffering, kind of a sense of kindness and care. That's the same for ourselves as well as for others. But it's more than just being kind to yourself. I mean, that's crucial. But at least the way I define self-compassion, a really important piece of it is a sense of common humanity, recognizing that all people are imperfect, all people lead imperfect lives, and although we know this logically, what happens emotionally when we fail or we get that diagnosis, something happens, we feel something has gone wrong. you know, this isn't supposed to be happening, as if baseline is perfection, and somehow things have really gone horribly astray when they aren't perfect. And then what happens with that is we feel abnormal and isolated and even ashamed in our failure, as opposed to recognizing this is the human experience. So self-compassion remembers the imperfection is the human experience. And it also does so in a mindful way, right? So mindfulness refers to the clear seeing and acceptance of things as they are in the present moment. So with self-compassion, we have to be able to accept this is painful, I messed up, I failed, I'm really struggling right now. But do it in a way that's not like full of drama, melodrama, woe is me. It's just saying this is what's happening. I can acknowledge it, I can validate it. Or this is what I did, I can acknowledge it and I can validate it. But also remember, this is only human, and be kind to myself in the face of that.
Okay, so we were a little bit late in getting started, precisely because I led you astray. In fact, I made a mistake.
Yes.
In fact, why don't you tell our listeners exactly what happened?
Great. So you, I think, probably transposed a number on the address you gave me. And so you said 3001 instead of 4001, right? So I went to the wrong place, and I emailed you, and we got it sorted out, and I'm here now.
And I guess it won't shock you if I were to tell you that felt like a crisis.
Yeah, well, isn't it funny how the smallest thing we get wrong, a lot of shame can come with it, as if, you know, you are never supposed to make mistakes. You know, you aren't supposed to transpose a number, as if, even though this is, you know, so incredibly common, so incredibly human, it happens to everyone, we feel as if we shouldn't do mistakes like that. And then not only do we make a mistake, then all of a sudden we are a mistake, and then we're bad, and then it just goes on from there. So self-compassion, and I would encourage you to do this, is to recognize, yeah, you know, maybe next time I give someone directions, I'll try to pay a little more attention now that I know that occasionally this can happen, but it's totally okay. It's fine. You didn't mean it. You're well-intentioned. You did the best you could. It's totally human. It's no big deal. Right. So a good way to learn how to treat yourself in situations like this is if one of your colleagues here said, oh, you know, Amane, I can't believe it. I gave someone a mistransposed number. What would you say to them? You'd probably be a lot kinder and more supportive than your immediate instinct is with yourself. So we need to really learn how to treat ourselves as a good friend with kindness, understanding, and patience. But sadly, it actually doesn't come naturally. We're much kinder to others than we are to ourselves.
Or the superego comes in with its own particular kind of distinctly unhelpful feedback. Like,
right.
Well, Ike, see what happens when you don't get enough sleep for the last 30 years? You know,
right.
That kind of thing.
Right, yeah. So the voice of, I call it the inner critic. You could also call it the superego if you want. It's a very interesting and important thing to pay attention to, because it usually takes a very harsh, punitive tone in most people. And there's part of us that feels, and I think we've really been taught this by our culture, that we need this harsh, punitive tone to keep in line, to not make mistakes, to recover when we do make mistakes, to try harder next time. And in a way, we have to have a lot of compassion for the inner critic, because it is trying to help us, right? Its motives are good. It's trying to say, hey, I don't want you to get in trouble. I want you to avoid danger. Pay attention. The problem with the inner critic is the way it expresses its message is completely counterproductive, right? So if you're afraid of bashing yourself with harsh self-criticism, it's going to be much harder for you to see yourself clearly. Right, the defensive part of your ego is going to, if it can get away with it, blame someone else for your mistakes. It doesn't want to own up to it because it's too painful. Right. Also, the agitated state of mind, the anxiety produced by self-criticism. So self-criticism triggers the amygdala, sets off a cortisol reaction, makes us anxious, nervous, does not put us in the state of mind needed to do our best or even to do better again next time. So again, it's natural, it's normal, you know, that part of ourselves is trying to protect us. We don't want to start judging ourselves for judging ourselves or beating ourselves up because we beat ourselves up. This is a natural human phenomenon also. But when you become aware that actually this isn't helping me, there's a better way. If I, you know, I can motivate myself much more effectively with kindness and encouragement, like a friend or an ally or supportive coach, then we can just learn to form new habits with ourselves. But it does take some intentionality because, first of all, physiologically, I think we evolved to be threat-focused. There's a reason, you know, problems, danger is the first thing to come to mind because evolutionarily that helped us survive. But then also our culture gives us that message, right? You know, we used to say, spare the rod, spoil the child. We've dropped that for parenting, but we have not dropped that with ourselves. So we come by these beliefs honestly, I think.
Right. And you know, this conversation feels so familiar.
Mm-hmm.
If I may, speaking on behalf of the cranky community, my sense is that for some people, probably more than a few, one stumbling block is the fact that negativity just feels more credible on a visceral level.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I know one of my gut level reactions
mm-hmm.
To the kind of thing that you're saying is not that it's completely infeasible, but it would take some work to come up with a mode of self-forgiving self-talk,
mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't sound like bullshit, frankly.
It doesn't sound like bullshit. And I think that's true for many people at first. Treating yourself with respect and kindness feels odd. It feels weird. And I think you're onto something. That's an interesting insight. Somehow that if it's negative, it's more credible. But of course, if you start picking that apart, it's completely illogical, right? The truth is black and white, positive and negative. We are imperfect human beings with many strengths and many weaknesses. So to only focus on the weaknesses and the mistakes is a completely distorted picture of reality. But again, because we're threat-focused, because our brains are designed to look for problems and to solve them, it naturally wants to go to the problem because it somehow feels safer if it's fixing a problem, right? So again, like I said, this is a natural tendency, and it does take some work. So you have to build a new habitual way of relating to yourself. But you can do it. I mean, there's lots of research showing that people can learn to practice being more self-compassionate. Some of the biggest stumbling blocks you need to get through before you can even be willing to take the step is to realize how we have so many misconceptions about self-compassion that get in our way. We think somehow it's going to make us self-indulgent or lazy or selfish, and that part of ourselves that doesn't want to be selfish or lazy or self-indulgent so that you shouldn't go down this path. But again, once you start looking at it clearly, you realize all that is completely false. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. That's what the research is showing. Yeah.
I have had therapists,
mm-hmm.
And this whole subject, in fact, self-compassion, is mm-hmm. one of my favorite conversational chew toys.
Okay.
I really struggle with it,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
And just to try to make this a little bit more concrete,
mm-hmm.
It seems to me that one of self-compassion's most formidable opponents is memory. And by that I mean all that we remember about the things that we've done. The things that we've done to ourselves, the things that we've done to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, you know, when I was an undergraduate, and what was supposed to be, should have been, you know, my senior semester, Without getting into all the gory details, let's just say that I crashed and burned. Mm-hmm. And I subsequently spent the next 8 years doing the makeup work that I needed to do in order to finally get my BA. It's a little bit astonishing just how muted the celebration was at the tail end of that.
Right.
Not that it had to be, but I just let it be that. And it is when I allow myself to dwell too much on it, my mind just boggles. How much I cost myself, how much time I lost. Arguably the most self-injurious thing that I've ever done.
You know what I think is going on when that happens and the inner critic goes in, is what the inner critic's saying is that shouldn't have happened. Okay? Perfection actually was possible if you would just try that little bit harder. Our inner critic is terrified. Remember, our inner critic comes from a place of fear. It's much more comfortable hating ourselves, even though it's really painful, but holding out the hope that maybe if I just tried a little bit harder, I could get everything perfect, than it is really acknowledging and opening to the fact that life isn't perfect. Stuff happens. We make mistakes. Sometimes we blow it royally, right? This is the human condition. So self-criticism is not going to make us better human beings. In fact, the irony is just the opposite. If you go around fearing making another big mistake, being anxious or maybe blinding reality from yourself because it's too painful to see, you can be in a much less healthy and balanced position to be able to do better next time, right? So again, it's understandable. And so as you look at yourself and you look at your own pattern of thinking, you might say, ah, that's the part of me who's trying to take care of myself. Thank you. Its goal is the same as the compassionate part of yourself, and that's to keep yourself safe. But one is just has a much more effective way to do it. And the thing about self-compassion, another reason it's so different than self-esteem, is it doesn't require, in fact, it requires that we not be just positive thinkers. You know, no, I'm not getting better in every way, you know, day by day. I'm not stronger and healthier. As a matter of fact, I'm getting old and I make mistakes and I've got weak and I've got this flaw that keeps coming up. And can we embrace that? Can we embrace ourselves exactly as we are, including our imperfections, and be okay with that? Not expect that somehow we should be better than other human beings, you know, i.e. perfect. And when you start to do that, things shift. Right, so what happens is our sense of safety comes from the fact that we know we always have our own back. We are always there to catch ourselves, to support ourselves, to be a friend to ourselves when either we fail a mistake or we get rear-ended on the freeway, even things that are not our own fault. Right, so we use this new way to build the sense of safety to the point where the self-critic, it's just not as effective anymore, and it doesn't have to shout so loudly. So you aren't saying anything false. You aren't saying, I'm great, I'm wonderful, I'm perfect. Just the opposite. You're saying, I am flawed. I'm deeply flawed. I'm deeply human. I really, really blew it when I did that. I hurt someone's feelings. Whatever it is, you need the safety of self-compassion to fully embrace reality. And then embracing that reality with kindness and care will actually give you the balanced point of view you need to cope much more effectively.
I'm sure that that your line of work gives you ample opportunities to talk to people in high-pressure jobs.
Yes.
Or we live in a very evaluative society. Mm-hmm. And a very competitive one too.
Yes.
And it's not totally chimerical that the possibility that if you screw up badly enough, it might cost you dearly in someone else's mind.
Of course.
And so
I'm all for not screwing up.
Yeah.
What's going to help you not screw up more, self-criticism or self-compassion? Self-compassion. It helps you be more motivated. It makes you less afraid of failure. When you do fail, it gives you the support needed to try again, to persist at learning after you fail, right? So given that, you know, would that it be that perfection was an option, then I'd say go for it. But given that it's not, what's the best strategy we can use to deal with the fact that we are imperfect human beings who make mistakes constantly? Well, self-compassion, kindness, and support. That's going to acknowledge reality, but in a way that's going to help us, right? Help us make the best of any situation. And then the other beautiful thing about self-compassion, you know, the word self makes people think, oh, self, 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 it's all about me. Well, actually, what happens is when you can calm your agitated mind, when you can get out of the dark hole of self-criticism and feeling inadequate, when your mind is filled with the sense of kind of kindness and connectedness toward yourself, that's what you communicate to the world. In every interaction you have, when you're in a place of, you know, kind, connected presence, which is really kind of what my self-compassion is, you're helping that other person feel that kindness and the connection and the presence. So you aren't just helping yourself, you're also helping others directly by cultivating a healthier state of mind. So really, it may feel uncomfortable, it may feel fake. You have to try it out to see how it works for you. If it does feel fake, you want to make sure you aren't saying things in a fake way. So for instance, here's something, and I teach a lot of workshops on self-compassion, here's something we say about it. We give ourselves compassion not to feel better, but because we feel bad. So think about it. If you're giving yourself compassion because I want to make the pain go away, I actually want to be perfect, I don't want to have this imperfect human life anymore, then you're trying to manipulate your reality, and it's not going to work because, well, A, that's not reality, right? And you're just trying to resist reality, and it'll make things worse. But because you hurt, because you feel bad, because you're inadequate, because you feel shame, because you've messed up or you failed or you're broken in some way, because of that, you open your heart to yourself. It's just like a child, just like a mother would tend to her child with the flu. Mother doesn't tend to her child with the flu to make the flu go away. The mother tends to the child because she's suffering, right? So she pats her head and maybe gives her a caress. And that's what we can do with ourselves by fully embracing the pain of our experience. Then what we're doing is the pain is still there. Pain doesn't go away. But we're generating this field of warmth and care and tenderness that embraces the pain. And that's there also. And that's what makes all the difference in terms of our ability to cope.
Okay. This is related to what I said a minute ago about memory. Mm-hmm. It isn't just that we live in an evaluative society. Mm-hmm. We live in a record-keeping society.
Yep.
And so, for, you know, again, to make this as concrete as I can, Sally Mae isn't about to forgive my student loans as much as I would like to. And so, I guess if you can think of it as a kind of societal memory, that one other thing that self-compassion is always vying with.
So self-compassion is not magic dust that will make the world a perfectly forgiving, compassionate place, or that will make your problems go away, or that will make your stress go away, or, you know, your other obligations go away. What self-compassion does is helps you hold and be with reality as it is. And I personally think that as we change ourselves, again, create this sense of connected, kind presence, we can help change the world interaction by interaction, moment by moment. But in the big picture, no. But it will help us cope with what is. So, you know, what we need to do is look to that part of us that really wishes it was perfect. I wish I could have a pain-free life. I wish I could get it right all the time. And although it's very natural, that wish is very natural, it comes from actually a deep sense of care for ourselves and a desire for safety, it just isn't so. So we can either choose to beat our head against the wall of reality, you know, keep trying to be perfect, keep trying to have our lives perfect, even though it's impossible, Or we can embrace that imperfection. And we can embrace our own imperfect selves. And in the midst of the dark times, in the midst of the failure, in the midst of the shame, we also have this, I'll be so bold as to say love. You know, we're actually in a state of love in the midst of all the darkness. And that love is the light that kind of carries us through. And it's not dependent on conditions. That's the key. Self-compassion is not dependent on conditions. You know, the bigger the failure, the more your heart has to open to hold it, but then it can. It's infinite, I believe, is my experience. You know, I've gone through some pretty dark times in my own life, and self-compassion absolutely got me through.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of record keeping, you know, I have my own name for the inner critic, the auditor. You know, the keeper of the ledger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a way of personifying this this unforgiving memory.
Yeah.
And I think, and like you said a minute ago, he has the best of intentions.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it takes some figuring out to, you know, to cut him down to size, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of sounds like what you're getting at.
Well, what if you tried not to cut it down to size? What if you just tried saying, you know, whenever that voice came up, oh, thank you for trying to keep me safe. Thank you. Thank you. And then make some room for another voice so he's not dominating the picture, so he's not shouting so loudly that no other voice can get through. But if you try to shut him down, anytime we resist something unpleasant, it actually usually just gets stronger and gets worse.
Right.
So there's no need to get rid of your inner critic. Be kind to your inner critic, be appreciative, be thankful, and then let it do its own thing. But at the same time, what seeds are you planting? You know, are you planting seeds of kindness? Are you saying kind words, even if they feel totally phony? Speaking to yourself like you would speak to a good friend. You're setting your intention to change the way you relate to yourself. And by continually, repeatedly setting this intention, it will start to happen on its own. But we actually don't have a lot of control about this. And that's scary. But, you know, we at least can do something. And that's try our best. And like I say, I've taught thousands and thousands of people self-compassion, and it's easier than you think. That's what always astonishes me. It seems like self-criticism is such an entrenched problem, such an ingrained habit, and people are, they often find it remarkable how quickly it can start to transform their lives. Just the simple attempt to be more of a kind friend to themselves. It's really not rocket science. We know how to do it. Most of us have a whole life of being kind to other people. We know what to say. We know the tone to say it in. We just got to get used to saying it to ourselves, and it will happen.
Yeah. Well, I have had it said to me that the auditor can't be allowed to have the floor all to itself. But I think you might be the first person who's ever suggested that. That there's a way that that we can extend compassion to the inner critic.
Absolutely crucial. I have a very powerful exercise I use with people to teach them how to motivate themselves with compassion. The key factor, the crucial factor, is having compassion for the inner critic. Really understanding, really listening to what the inner critic is trying to say, where it's trying to point out dangers, how it's trying to keep you safe. I even have people write a letter of thanks to the inner critic. And then once it's acknowledged, once it's validated, it's amazing, then it doesn't have to shout so long. It doesn't, you know, so loudly. It doesn't have to take over the entire, what do you say, take the entire floor or all your mental space. Because it can calm down, it can relax, because this message has been received, it's been given this appreciation. And then you add another voice, not to drown out the old voice, but just a little bit of the other voice in, which is also there, usually just isn't being heard as much, but it's also there. I believe the inner compassionate voice is always there. We just maybe have to listen to it a little more carefully, but yeah.
So
I'm going to give you a task. Every time the auditor comes up, say, "Thank you, inner auditor, for trying to keep me safe. I really appreciate it." That's it.
Okay.
See what happens.
Thank you for that.
See if it screams more loudly or gets a little quieter.
All right.
Let me know how it goes.
Yeah. When was the last time that you've ever had to really labor at self-compassion yourself?
Whenever it comes a lot more easily to me now because I've been practicing it pretty steadily for about 18 years. So it's really kind of a habit of mine with me. So I don't have to try hard, but it doesn't mean my self-critic isn't there. It doesn't mean I don't feel shame. So shame's always a challenge because when you feel shame, shame kind of obliterates the sense of self. It's this overwhelming desire to hide, right? And when you're hiding from yourself and, you know, you have no sense of self to stand on, it's kind of hard. It's harder. It's not impossible, but it's harder to find that part of ourselves that can accept and, you know, you just really, really, really wish it weren't true that you said that or did that, but it is. So, you know, sometimes it takes a little time, but, you know, I think for me, because I've just seen it over and over again, there's no part of myself anymore that isn't convinced that self-compassion is what I need and is going to help me and is actually, from my point of view, self-compassion is reality. You know, it's embracing reality as it is as opposed to changing reality to be something it's not. So, you know, it can be harder, I think, especially in the case of shame, but it might take me half an hour.
Right.
You know, so it's not going to be really persistent. Now, of course, who knows, you talk to me in a couple of weeks, if I do something really bad, maybe it'll take me longer, but you just learn to trust it. You know, you can learn to trust this part of yourself, your inner ally, you might want to call it. People don't like the term self-compassion, dump it. Use a term like inner friend, inner ally. You know, it's really a very stable source of support. You get to learn that after calling on it often enough. You know?
Okay.
So.
I would think that, and I think that this is implicit in what you've been saying, is that because of our tendency to divide ourselves from other people, cognitive vice that a person can fall into is thinking that self-compassion is the sole preserve of the beautiful people, or people who've already attained a certain plateau.
Huh.
Of success in their lives.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, which actually, if you think about it, goes completely counter to the embracing of imperfection and failure and inadequacy, right? So, you know, and I certainly, from what I've seen, would not say that people who are highly successful are more self-compassionate. If anything, just the opposite. A lot of people really suffer from perfectionism and just driving themselves into the ground from striving and striving and striving. And a lot of people, you might say, more simple lives, maybe not fancy careers or fancy degrees, but can be really happy, just more living at ease with themselves and their lives. So I certainly haven't noticed a correlation between the two, except if there is one, it may be inverse.
Right.
But yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I think one other potential source of what I referred to earlier as unforgiving memory is family, intimates.
Yep.
I mean, in so many ways, it's a lot easier to say to a stranger, that's not a big deal.
Self-compassion doesn't necessarily say it's not a big deal. Sometimes self-compassion says it is a big deal.
Well, if that is what you say, or fill in the blank with something apt.
You have to be careful. So I can see where you're coming from a little bit, and this gets a little slippery slope.
Yeah.
So self-compassion, is it forgiving? Yes, it's forgiving, but it's not at all saying that things aren't bad, or
yeah.
that wrong hasn't been done, or that some great, you know, bad deed was committed. In fact, self-compassion allows you to take more responsibility to what you've done and to apologize for it, right? So it's not in any way, shape, or form letting you off the hook. Sometimes
right.
people think forgiveness is saying, oh, it's fine. You know, it's not fine. What self-compassion does is give you the courage. Self-compassion is hugely, it's a hugely courageous act. It gives you the courage to say, wow, I did do that, you know? And maybe you can't forgive me. Maybe I hurt you too deeply. And if I forgive myself, again, I don't even really talk about forgiveness that much because it can be so easily misconstrued with condoning or not calling a spade a spade or not
uh-huh.
owning up to
yeah.
the fact that... For me, it's all about owning, holding. Wow, I did that. That is painful. Yeah.
Right.
And but you can hold even that. And you know, really, what's our choice? It did happen. We can pretend it didn't, but it did. It's going to affect our future actions. How are we going to move forward in a way that's going to help us? It's going to make us less likely to cause harm again. The only thing we can, or I shouldn't say the only, the best thing we have at our disposal is self-compassion. That will give us the resources and the strength and the clarity needed to do our best next time.
I think I may have pretty much taken up about enough of your time.
Okay.
Is there anything else, just by way of putting a bow on this, that comes to mind as particularly salient when you talk about self-compassion?
Yeah, well, maybe, and I've certainly touched on this, but people really labor under the delusion that self-compassion is weak. Some other think self-criticism is strong, and if I'm self-compassionate, it'll be weak, wimpy, passive. You know, I can say without a doubt that research is showing that self-compassion is one of the absolute most powerful factors of strength, coping, and resilience that we have at our disposal. Self-compassion is an act of courage, not an act of weakness. It will, you know, vets coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, their level of self-compassion predicts whether or not they'll develop PTSD more than level of combat exposure, right? So even more powerful than how intense the fighting you saw was is how you related to yourself in the aftermath of that fighting. So it's an incredibly strong, powerful source of coping with their lives, coping with stress, coping with their own imperfection, coping with whatever life throws your way. So, you know, I would say try not to be scared off from self-compassion because of these misconceptions we have about it. Try it out for yourself and see what happens.
Okay. Dr. Kristen Neff,
right.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For joining us, and thank you in particular for being willing to indulge my digressions.
Well, thank
That's
you for being willing to be human, because your experience is the same as many others, and I think it's... I'm also, I tend to expose myself as well. I think it's a really powerful way of communicating to people what's happening, so I appreciate that. I really do.